By this means the powers of each are tremendously augmented, and the whole nature is vivified and brought to the highest perfection of its capacities. If the greater cosmic forces should be called down by an individual who is not working in conjunction with another who is a suitable channel of return, they will be very apartment to make a path of returning for themselves through any conductile vehicle that approaches sufficiently close, leaping the gap like an electric spark. And if the individual who receives the force be of insufficient caliber to carry the voltage, her emotional nature will, metaphorically speaking, fuse, and there will be an open circuit of cosmic forces which will also fuse the positive or male vehicle, burn all in their immediate neighborhood, and break the contact with the divine forces. Anyone who is familiar with those circles that are interested in occult studies must have seen this happen, for it is a very common occurrence among those who, while only partially instructed, seek to operate the unseen forces. How often does some man, who as a teacher and initiator is doing fine work, suddenly cast all aside for the sake of a woman who, utterly unworthy of him, drags him down from the high calling whereunto he was called? This is so common an occurrence that those who have knowledge are most cautious, and rightly so, ere enrolling themselves as pupils under outstanding personalities, however great may be the benefits to be derived from so doing, for the blowing of a fuse on the physical plane is as nothing to what happens when an analogous accident happens in occult work. If these forces be rightly understood and employed, however, the highest occult work can be done in safety. It is because the perfect circuit is not always available that the handling of certain potencies becomes a dangerous task. Devices of the nature of lightning conductors have to be employed, and they are not always perfectly satisfactory. It must not be thought that occultists dwell intemperately upon the subject of sex, or that they are more sensual than their fellowmen who follow other lines of study, but, as their researches are into the very foundations of human nature, they must take the sexual forces into their calculations, or else they would run the risk of being caught unawares by the tides they have ignored. Occultists deal with the forces of life itself, and one aspect of life force is certainly sex force. As has been shown in a previous chapter, the life forces run down through all the seven bodies of man as pure force, and are conditioned by the nature of the body, mental, emotional, or physical, as the case may be, through which they take form. Life itself is not thought any more than it is sperm, but if it is used to drive the machinery of the mental body it will produce thought, and if it is turned into the machinery of the reproductive organs it will produce sperm. It will, in fact, go to whatever part of our nature we direct our attention. And if we have not trained ourselves sufficiently in thought control to be sure of keeping our minds off any particular subject for a certain period, we are running grave risks if we open the channels of our nature to more force than it is normally constructed to deal with. This risky enlargement of receptiveness is affected by certain forms of breathing, meditation, or ritual magic. And the risk lies in the fact that if a sensual thought intrude into consciousness at a time when the channels are open and the forces are flowing, those forces will immediately follow the focus of attention, and the result will be an outbreak of passion and sensuality. It is by concentration of thought that these powers are held to their work, just as the automobile is steered by the driver's hands. If attention waver, the direction of their power will waver with it. To use a big occult potency is like driving a high-powered car at a high speed. All depends on the control. Unless you have the nerve for it, you are safe or on your feet. Many people experiment in the invocation of forces, but few are aware of their reality until they find themselves out of their depth. The rightly trained occultist, knowing these facts, will refrain, then, from certain kinds of work if he is unable to obtain a complete circuit for the cosmic force. It was said to the writer once, "Ao, only those who are rightly married can go to the higher degrees. A the most important work is done by the pair, not by the solitary worker, who is always more or less unstable, and nothing in occultism is more undesirable than instability. For such work the closest sympathetic rapport of the higher nature is necessary. And such intimacy and propinquity is only sanctioned by our society when it has been regularized by marriage. union upon the physical plane need not take place, and, in fact, will not take place while the life forces are being used upon other levels, but when that work is not going on, and few have the stamina to keep it up continuously and without respite, then the forces will tend to follow their natural channel, and if that channel is not open, trouble may ensue. Moreover, should certain of the operations of practical magic not be entirely successful, then it is very advantageous to be able to run the unutilized forces off through the ordinary channels of nature upon the physical plane. It is possible for a man and a woman to work together for a lifetime without having recourse to the physical plane, but it is only highly evolved and disciplined natures that are capable of such a restraint, and people who undertake a partnership that cannot, if necessary, be placed upon the basis of legal marriage, should realize that they have set themselves no light task. It may be deemed unjust that anyone should be delayed in their spiritual progress because circumstances have denied them a suitable partner. This, however, is not the case when envisaged from the point of view of the occultist. If the student has advanced far enough to undertake the operations indicated in the foregoing pages, he will be an initiate of the greater mysteries, and will have shifted the focus of his life from the personality to the individuality. He will have some memory of past incarnations, realize that they are phases of his existence, and his sense of the Aoia will stretch beyond both birth and death. He will know that the circumstances of his present life depend upon conditions in past lives, just as the circumstances of our old age depend upon the actions of our youth and manhood. He will see a future of many lives stretching out before him, and he will know that that future is under his control, therefore he does not feel that he must taste or forego any particular experience altogether before death shall overtake him. Certain work he may decide to set aside for another incarnation, seeing that the conditions of this one are unsuitable for its execution. The fact that he feels an urge to mate does not necessarily mean that he is ready for the great cosmic mating which we are here contemplating. Such a union requires more than his own decision, but should he have come to the point when he must handle focused cosmic forces, then for this purpose he will have to effect the cosmic mating, which is a mating, not of personal love, but of capacity for service along the same lines of power. No love may enter into the union at the outset. Indeed, it may be a union of complete strangers, although out of the deep harmony necessary for the formation of a circuit, love may grow. The cosmic tie is a union that is entered into by two individuals for the purpose of performing certain occult work that can only be carried out by two units functioning in polarity. It has nothing whatever to do with love or attraction as ordinarily understood. It is motived by service and nothing else. It is partnership entered into for the sake of the work to be performed. The participants in this union do not choose their partners, they offer themselves for service to the master on the inner planes, whose pupils they are, and by the wisdom of a higher plane they are mated with regard to their qualities and capacities for service according to ray color. The essential difference between the karmic and the cosmic tie lies in the fact that the karmic tie begins upon the lowest plane and works upwards as body after body comes into function, whereas the cosmic tie begins upon the highest plane and works downwards. The karmic tie is part of the normal discipline of evolution, the cosmic tick is supernormal in that it belongs to a different code of laws altogether to that which governs the general order of mankind. It is one of the greater mysteries, and, as such, is reserved for initiates, and is only referred to here because so many are essaying these mysteries without initiation are experimenting with great natural forces in entire ignorance of their nature and potency, and therein lies danger. Chapter 19. How souls find their mates. Souls can achieve mating in three different ways. Firstly, through the ordinary attractions of sex, secondly, by the renewing of karmic ties, and thirdly, according to the higher cosmic laws. Each of these forms of attraction needs to be understood if we are to adjust our lives truly and harmoniously, for each of us may be drawn to another in all three ways, and we must not forget that as long as we are human at all we shall have capacity for response to the lure of sex, a capacity which needs to be qualified by the guidance of the reason lest it prove a dangerous and short-sighted guide. The readiness of our response to the lure of sex is due to the rise and fall of certain physiological tides within the organism, and we must always remind ourselves that the appeal a certain person makes to our emotions may simply be due to the fact that we are in an emotional state, broadly speaking. After the age of puberty has been reached, a member of the opposite sex will attract us unless that person has attributes whose repulsiveness suffices to counterbalance the fascination. Discrepancies of age, social status, or physical defects neutralize the instinctive attraction, unless that attraction is exceptionally strong. Should there be no immediate barrier, however, and mating take place in response to a physical urge translated as emotion, then the success of that mating will depend upon the harmony or disharmony revealed by experience between the two characters. A union entered into without reflection is as much dependent upon luck for its happiness as is the turning up of double sixes in a throw of dice and as rare. Such unions are surprisingly common, even among those who would be reckoned as educated and enlightened. Young people, feeling the unaccustomed pressure of the sex tides steadily rising within them, marry as soon as their finances permit, and even sooner, in order to escape from the emotional stresses to which they are subjected, and to make their appetites fit in with their ideals. They erroneously irrationalize their feelings and amazingly idealize the object of them, with the result that their physical needs being satisfied and rendered quiescent, they wake up to find themselves bound for life to a person who is incapable of satisfying any of their other needs of mind, heart, or spirit. Misery follows, taught by experience. They learn too late the requirements of harmonious mating. We have only to look around us to see how often a second marriage is a happy one, but, unfortunately, our laws denying the opportunity of a second marriage unless death or public divorce terminate the first, men and women live on in a union which has failed of its purpose, or enter into an arrangement upon which society's disapproval weighs so heavily that it seldom fulfills its purpose either. But though the vast majority of us marry in obedience to nature's simplest laws, the laws under whose sway are the flowers of the field and the beasts that perish, but which are, nonetheless, divine laws and not to be despised, let us also realize that matings of higher types are governed by higher laws, obedience to which will ensure harmony. People who have read esoteric literature, and have realized that there are other bonds between souls than those of sexual attraction, may be tempted to despise these simple but most potent forces, and to refuse a union which they fear may be commonplace for the sake of some destined karmic mate to whom they have been bound in past lives, and whose coming they await. Herein lies one of the dangers of the divulgence of secret occult doctrines. Had such an one known nothing of occultism, he might have made a happy union according to nature's laws, but, knowing enough to reject the guidance of his instincts, and insufficient to differentiate between fantasies arising from subconscious wishes and the promptings of the individuality, he may throw away the lower without gaining the higher. The trained occultist knows how to countercheck these things, the seeker does not. The methods of countercheckingpsychism cannot be given here. The reader is advised to make an earnest self-examination before staking his own and another person's happiness on an unverified impulse which may be unreasonable. Under such circumstances, he should test and countercheck his impulse as carefully as lies in his power. First, he should allow himself ample time to discover whether his intuitive feeling that there is some soul to whom he is bound by karmic ties strengthens or weakens with the passage of months, or even years. Secondly, if there is a destined mate awaiting him, any reliable psychic ought to be able to discern the fact and confirm his impression. Psychics, however, are no more infallible than doctors, especially such psychics as make a business matter of a sacred power, and whoever makes use of their services would do well to consult at least three, and see if their readings tally with one another. In addition to this, an astrologer provided with data for a horoscope will be able to tell almost the exact date when the fateful meeting will take place. Unless the reports of the psychics confirm each other, and astrologers, casting horoscopes independently, agree as to date, The would-be explorer of the unseen would be wise to regard the promptings of his intuition as indications of the needs of his own nature as translated by the fantasies of his subconscious mind, and to wait until the call to initiation comes, as come it will when he is ripe, before seeking to explore the unseen without a guide, and run the risks involved in so doing. A well-known writer, discoursing upon love and marriage and casting ridicule upon the idea that any tie beyond instinctive attraction could exist between men and women, pointed out that it was a curious coincidence that soulmates should be born in the same neighborhood, or, out of the whole huge world, meet each other when the mating time comes. Esoteric science teaches, however, that agencies are actually at work to bring about these meetings, just as similar agencies govern the migrations of the birds and the return of the comets. It is, of course, well known that the date of a comet's return can be confidently predicted by the mathematics of astronomy. With regard to the meetings of a soulmate, so they are regulated by the workings of the force popularly known as karma, or destiny, the sum total of the causes set going in the past which determine the conditions of the present. Into the details of these laws it is impossible to enter in these pages. It must suffice to say that, after death, souls gather into themselves the fruits of the experiences of the life that is just finished, and when the time comes for them to incarnate again, they are sent into incarnation through the agency of certain forces at the moment when the planetary influences give the conditions for the working out of the appointed fate. Therefore, an astrologer who knows the exact moment of birth can, by a study of the horoscope, tell what karma has to be worked out in the course of the incarnation and also the exact dates when the crises will occur. These secret laws form an important part of the studies of occult science, and by means of a knowledge of their workings, predictions can be made with considerable accuracy. The details of their workings are too complex for consideration in these pages, and it must suffice to say, concerning the nature of the karmic tie between souls, that it will act as the tides of the sea, and only the greatest of adepts can influence its effects. We cannot control the results of the causes we have set going in past lives, though we can control our reactions to the conditions they bring to us. It is only in the future that we can find full scope for our will, for in the ever-moving present we are setting in motion the causes that will meet us face to face when their circuit is completed. Second section. In knowledge of the laws of cosmic mating lies our best hope of deliverance from difficulties in which ignorance and false doctrines have involved the AE marriage problem. In an earlier stage of evolution, man lived close to nature, knew less of free will, memory, and reason, and was entirely guided by his instincts. When course of time brought the development of the higher mind, however, the problem was greatly complicated. Instinct was a sufficient guide when the mating of the lower planes of the personality alone was involved, but when the individuality with its relationship to evolution and the cosmos as a whole began to function and required mating for its full development and expression, instinct was no longer an adequate guide because factors had to be taken into consideration which were beyond the scope of the lower nature. Reason and spiritual intuition have to be employed for the direction of the greater self. We have to rise superior to the pain and pleasure of the moment, or even of the incarnation, and base our lives upon the universal and eternal if the greater life that looks beyond birth and death is to be fulfilled of its purpose. Let us imagine the case of a man who, while capable of normal response to the call of sex, and having, as we all have, ties with the past, desires to be bound by none of these things, but to mate upon the highest plane that evolution has opened up for the functioning of our race. What must be his procedure? Upon the physical plane he will remain entirely passive, neither seeking nor avoiding any contact that might bring to him his mate. Upon the lower astral plane he will call home the passions, and try so to sublimate them by abstemious living and thought control that they shall not be insistent, for it is not by the light of the passions that a mate can be chosen according to the higher laws. Upon the third plane of the tender affections he should let love flow out to all things so that, by whatever path the mate may come, she may be met by love and drawn within the gate. Then he should raise his consciousness to the highest plane upon which he is capable of functioning by meditating upon the loftiest ideals that he can conceive, and, with consciousness elevated to this state, he should dwell upon the characteristics of the mate who would satisfy his needs. Having dwelt upon these characteristics till a well-defined image is built up in his mind, he may then imagine himself seeking and calling, making himself heard by the very insistence of his endeavor, until a soul, whose nature shall have placed it upon the plane to which he has lifted himself by meditation, shall hear the call and respond. When such a union has been effected upon the inner planes, its effects become visible in the inner life long before any meeting takes place upon the plane of manifestation. The peace of true mating comes upon the soul though no mate has as yet appeared in the world of sense. Sometimes the meeting never takes place upon the physical plane, karmic conditions forbidding, but their rapport remains and can be developed and yield all that the higher nature requires. Indeed, a mate may be found who has passed the phase of evolution during which incarnation takes place, and that strange partnership between the unseen and the seen may be built up. It is by such a partnership that much of the work of the masters is carried on. These things can be no more than hinted at. Those who are sufficiently evolved to experience them are sufficiently evolved to obtain the guidance they need. Again, warning must be given against mistaking subjective fantasy for objective fact. Our safest guide in these matters is humility, which does not imagine great things of itself, but seeks to serve in all ways that lighter hand and accepts gratefully what each day brings. To the humble and kind the great experiences come, rather than to those who are urged on by curiosity and ungratified vanity. People who cannot deal with life successfully upon a single plane of existence are ill-advised to multiply their difficulties by expanding their consciousness. Chapter 20, Tarek Teaching Concerning Marriage. One of the chief causes of the problems surrounding marriage in modern life is the convention which prevents us from honestly facing the facts with which we have to deal. The esoteric scientist, whose aim it is to understand and control the causes behind appearances, has, by the very nature of his pursuit, to look facts in the face. It will have been noticed that, in the preceding pages, much has been said concerning mating of souls. But the word a.e. marriage has seldom been used, and for this reason, that mating and marriage are in fact two different things. Amatinga means the functioning in polarity of two organisms so that, for the time being, they form the halves of a single whole. Marriage is a legal contract. Mating is an actual fact. One is either mated or not mated, just as the electric light is turned either on or off. But marriage is a fluctuating convention. Who would maintain that an English marriage, with the free and honored status it accords to women, is the same thing as a Turkish marriage? Yet both are according to the law of their respective lands. And is an English marriage today the same as it was 100, or even 50 years ago? Marriage is a very great deal more than mating. It is a partnership in the business of life. And the marriage laws are society's attempt to standardize the treatment which the different members of the home are to receive from each other. Firstly, there are the duties of the husband and wife toward each other. Secondly, there are the obligations they undertake toward society through their children, and these duties and obligations have to be considered in the framing of marriage laws. Those marriage laws are the best which most closely approximate to a codification of natural laws. Unfortunately, the laws of marriage in England are very far from approaching to the perfection possible to such instruments, but under these laws we have to live, and the needs of human nature are obliged to achieve a compromise with the demands of the state. The esotericist considers the marriage laws and the keeping or breaking thereof from the point of view of karma. It is his aim to set no forces in motion save those which are in harmony with the divine law. If the marriage laws of his country are at variance with natural law, and he abide by them, he will suffer from his disregard of natural law, but he will lay up for himself no causes potent for evil in the future. On the other hand, should he disregard a social code, though he may enhance his own comfort, he will cause suffering to others, and that suffering, according to the laws of karma, will return upon his own head and delay his progress. Whether the marriage laws of a country are sound or not, we cannot get away from the fact that the marriage contract is a bargain, and that the breaker of promises forfeits his honor. Should, however, one party to a bargain fail to meet his obligations, then, according to the laws of contract, the other party is released. It is only in regard to the marriage contract that the law, instructed by theologians, retains the aggrieved person in bondage, and it is contrary to equity in so doing. The esotericist believes that failure to fulfill the obligations of marriage by one party leaves the other morally, if not legally, free, that is to say, from his obligations to his guilty partner, but not free to enter into unlegalized relations with a third person, because by so doing great suffering is caused by exposing that person to the rigors of the social code, and a terrible wrong may be done to a soul by causing it to incarnate under circumstances in which no proper home can be afforded to it. People have the right to sacrifice their own lives, but not those of others, and the occultist, believing a soul to be no less alive and personalized because for the moment it is unattached to a physical body, takes an even more serious view of unchastity than does the world at large, but he regards it not so much as an offense against the person as a sin against the unborn. If there were any certain method of preventing conception, then the matter would be upon a different footing, for the two adults concerned would affect no lives but their own. But the only certain method of preventing conception is to abstain from intercourse, and such abstention the laws of the higher life enjoin upon those who cannot legalize their union and its possible issue. Chapter 21, Esoteric Attitude Towards the Child. Esoteric science does not regard each child born into the world as a newly created soul. Though the little body is newly made, the life that ensouls it was individualized many thousands of years ago, and the experiences through which that life has passed determine the character traits of the new personality just as the causes set going in past lives determine the conditions into which it is reborn. If the parents make a good environment for the children they hope to have, souls of a high type can reincarnate through them. This, then, is the essence of the esotericist's concept of the relation of parent and child. The parents open a channel whereby a soul can reincarnate and so advance in its evolution, and this deed stands to the credit of the parents in the great account of fate. A point arises out of this concept which must be touched upon to render the concept clear, although it does not strictly concern the subject of esoteric sex. As each one of us affects the lives of those with whom we come in contact, bringing them good or evil, we are each agents of the fate that allots the dues earned in past existences. If we bring good to others, we thereby, under the law of cause and effect, lay up good for ourselves that we shall reap in the next life if not in this one, and if we do evil we shall likewise be repaid in our own coin. It may be argued that it is each person's fate that brings them good or evil, and therefore the agent of fate is not responsible for his actions towards them. The answer to this problem is, that though each person indeed draws towards himself the conditions that he has earned, his merit may cause him to be the vehicle of the good he has earned and not of the evil. If one has laid up a store of evil causation, it may be one's punishment to be the channel through which the suffering has to come, and so pay compound interest on wrongdoing. Ayo, it must be that evil come, but woe unto him through whom it comes. Even the best of parents may sometimes have to be the channel of suffering to their children through financial losses or unsuspected hereditary disease, but in order to get such happenings into their true perspective they must look at them from the standpoint of an evolution, not of a single incarnation, and train their children to make the best possible reaction to their environment, thus converting evil into good. It must also be remembered that suffering is not necessarily synonymous with evil, and that some valuable experiences only come through pain and trial. Parents, however, should carefully refrain from the deliberate admission of souls into poverty-stricken homes, or from running the risk of giving birth to children of an enfeebled or diseased physique, thereby piling up further evil for themselves in the future, and out of this arises the vexed question of the prevention of conception, which will be dealt with later, after an explanation of the conditions of incarnation will have rendered possible an understanding of this subject from the esoteric point of view. We will now consider what happens when a soul, having contemplated its sins in purgatory and its good deeds in a state equivalent to the ordinary concept of heaven, prepares to return once more to the earth in order to undergo further experience.